morning and welcome to Thinking Out Loud on KBIA. I'm Darren Helwedge. Tonight on our program, we meet the first family of Mizzou, R. Bowen Lofton, since last January, the chancellor of the University of Missouri's flagship campus here in Columbia, and his wife, Dr. Karen Lofton. We talk tonight in the first half of this two-part special about the interesting background of both Loftons. We'll hear the really fun story of how the couple met. We'll talk a lot about education and a lifetime for both of the Loftons in research and teaching. Part one of a conversation with Dr. R. Bowen Lofton and Dr. Karen Lofton, Thinking Out Loud on KBIA. It's Thinking Out Loud from KBIA, and we've got a couple of very special guests in our studio today. The doctors R. Bowen and Karen Lofton, the Chancellor and First Lady of the University of Missouri-Columbia campus, and we want to welcome you both. Thank you a lot for coming in today. It's great to talk to you.
Good to be here.
Thank you.
Let me start with you, Dr. Lofton,
the male Dr. Lofton.
I'm not sure how to exactly to do that. I come from a family full of PhDs, and there's always a little bit of confusion there. You've had a long career in education. I know you studied physics undergrad. Was administration or being in education in some way kind of the ultimate goal when you were growing up, or is this something you just kind of worked your way into along the way?
Oh, not a goal at all. When I was about 16 years old, going to high school in a very small town, I'm not sure why it happened. One day an epiphany came along, and I decided I want to be a college professor. I really wanted to do that. And that was my junior year in high school. It was one of those situations where I didn't know much about it, but I looked into it. I really did some research, what it would take to get there, and I realized that I had to pick a field of study. I had to get a quality degree and also have other degrees at the graduate level. Probably not from the same place. It was kind of an obvious thing, too, and you looked into it a bit. Yeah. So that's kind of how it started out. It was never an intent to be an administrator, to be really a college professor, teacher, researcher. That's what I wanted to do, and I got there in a very deliberate kind of way. Administration was kind of foisted off on me. and so I never really intended to be an administrator, put it that way.
I've got to ask, and I'm almost certain this is somebody that you're going to know, but a great old friend of mine that's been gone from this university for quite some time, but Haskell Monroe, when he was the chancellor here, always when I talked with him, seemed to have in the back of his mind that he was a professor that had all this other stuff added on. He just wanted to go teach history, man.
Haskell was a professor of history. Yes. At Texas A&M when I was undergrad there in the 60s. He became in the 50s, actually.
Oh, wow.
Been there a long time. And I could never get in his class. He was so popular among the students. There was a storyteller that his classes were oversubscribed. I never got into one of them. So I heard about him, knew about him. We met years later. When he left here as a Chancellor Emeritus, he actually came back to Texas, mm-hmm. Lives still in College Station, Texas, right next to the university there. And so he and I used to get together with a bunch of his cronies every Friday for coffee for a while.
I always had the suspicion that when Missouri and Texas A&M played in any sport, he was there with his black and gold on. But always you wondered in the back of his mind what was really going on.
He spent more time at A&M than in Missouri.
He was a good loyal Aggie. And then, Mrs., I want to ask you about your background, because you come from a very different setting, Mr. Lofton, from Navasota. Is that right?
Well, the name of the small town I grew up in is Navasota.
Navasota.
N-A-V-A-S-O-T-A, a small town about 25 miles south of College Station.
Okay. You started in a very different setting, in Hamburg, and came to Michigan at a relatively young age. You've had an interesting path.
Very much so. I think a lot of my ambition as far as going to college and a career stemmed, I think, from my German background, my German culture. The first individual that made a big impression on me was my personal physician or the family physician, and she was a female, which was still pretty unusual in this country back in the 50s. So I realized that, you know, I was able to do whatever I choose to do. And when I came to this country, I really did have the educational opportunities that I may not have had in Germany because of my socioeconomic status, if you will, or mm-hmm. my family's. And so I had opportunities here that I probably would not have had there.
And then you decided after high school to go into veterinary medicine, and it's not that unusual now to have women vets, but at the time that you started kind of moving in that direction, I understand that was not a field that really drew a lot of women in.
Well, not the fact that it didn't draw women. Women weren't accepted in the field,
okay,
like other fields too. I mean, medicine, it was still pretty unusual for women to enter the field of medicine. And I was interested in veterinary medicine, but more so in human medicine. And so I was really more driven than I've always enjoyed animals, obviously dogs, horses, and always been attracted to horses. And partly in Germany, the movies, the Western movies that we got, really,
fantastic.
You know, Gene Autry, I mean, and all of it was dubbed in English, I mean, in German. But nevertheless, you know, I kind of got exposed to it in that way.
I was more of a Roy Rogers guy, but I'm right there with you and all of that with the old cowboy movies. I used to love those. That may be part of kind of getting into my next question, and you don't get to answer this one, but coming from Hamburg and then Michigan, I understand you went to Dallas, and that's a culture jump, man. Going to Texas after being in much different places.
Correct. It was really my stepfather who had to move because of a job opportunity.
I see.
And back in the late, 70s, there was a swine cholera epidemic here in Texas. And so he worked for the Department of Agriculture. He was a meat inspector in Michigan. And so they offered him this position in Texas.
I see.
And so they moved to Texas. And at that time, I was already in college. And the only reason I moved down to Texas was because my family was here. And I had really no reason to stay in Michigan if they were down in Texas. And so I came down to Texas, too. And I always thought Texas would be a great state to come to because of all the horses. I figured everybody horse down in Texas.
wasn't necessarily, especially in Dallas. That's a car city. So.
That's right.
Yes. But I remember being in high school in Oklahoma City, and a kid moved in. This would have been eighth or ninth grade, and a kid moved in from L.A., and he got there, and he seriously was surprised when they landed and got there and discovered there were paved roads. He thought it was going to be like Little House on the Prairie. He thought we all still lived on dirt roads and whatnot, so that's kind of fun. We're talking with R. Bowen and Karen Lofton, the Chancellor and First Lady of the University of Missouri-Columbia. It's Thinking Out Loud on KBIA. I'll let both of you dive in on this one. I want to hear the story of how you guys met. Both of you obviously involved in education there in Texas. But
in a bar.
Okay. I'm all for that.
Qualify that a little bit.
Okay, please.
I was going to graduate school at Rice University in Houston, and across the street was one of the world's biggest medical centers. Mm. And Karen was going to grad school over there. And so we had a mutual friend, and we met through that mutual friend. But what's not really well known is that my first year at Rice, this is 1970-71, the graduate students were allowed to build a lounge, a bar for ourselves, basically, private university. So we were given space under the chemistry building and some wonderful old oak paneling that had been taken out of a mother building for renovation purposes. And we just constructed in this dank, dark, dusty place a small place to meet. And we served one thing there, Shiner Bock beer.
Oh, good stuff.
And I volunteered to bartend there one night a week. And one day, Karen's friend, who was dating a friend of mine, brought her there, and we met over the foosball table.
Oh, fantastic.
How romantic, huh?
Yeah, I love it. That's great. So he was running a bar in addition to other things.
That's
so,
right.
Okay.
Right.
Got to have skill sets to back up.
That's a good one. I like that one. I like that one. Now, with the understanding that while my dad is a chemist, I'm nowhere near any kind of science expert. I want to hear about your time at NASA, because there's got to be some fun stories. After your education, you got to spend some time at NASA and I guess literally a rocket scientist. So tell me about that.
Well, not exactly. What happened is as I went through the ranks in the professoriate, after I got tenure, I decided to kind of redirect my research efforts into areas which were more speculative, perhaps. You kind of play it safe. I kind of carried on the research I had done as a graduate student and postdoctoral fellow into my initial years as a professor. Yeah, I got tenure, promotion to associate professor, and I then was looking around, what do I want to do? And I was really interested in the problem of people learning. I was teaching physics and, quite frankly, had a lot of dropouts.
Right.
So I was very worried about how could it work. I noticed that if students came to me one-on-one or one-on-few for help in my office, that they could usually do well. And many didn't come by, didn't do so well. And so I realized that you know, I kind of knew how to communicate, but it was best done on a small scale, not in these large multi-hundred classrooms I was typically teaching. And that led me into the area of artificial intelligence, and especially what's called intelligent tutoring systems, the ability to capture what a teacher or tutor does one-on-one in terms of a computer program. So I got involved in that research effort, and that led to some publications, and I then was invited to spend a summer at the Johnson Space Center looking at that particular field. And also I had evolved into a whole big research program developing intelligent tutoring systems for the flight support personnel at NASA, not just at Johnson Space Center, but also at Kennedy Space Center in Florida and at Marshall Space Flight Center in Alabama. So I made a lot of rounds in those three centers, particularly for many years, capturing knowledge of how people did their jobs and trying to incorporate that in programs to teach others how to do the job. That just was a whole part of my life, basically, right there, and it was a lot of fun. And I took that same knowledge and ultimately began building Tutors for Physics.
I see.
Apple Computer and others, NSF, funded me a lot to do that kind of work for many years. Then moved from that into using simulation and computer graphics and got involved with what's called virtual reality at the time. Developing VR systems for both NASA but also for the military and for education. One of my colleagues, Chris Deedy, who's now at Harvard, and I spent many years with a lot of NSF support developing some very, very interesting systems, which were proven to be quite effective in teaching physics to students in elementary, middle school, high school, and college. The challenge was cost. These systems at that time in history cost too much money. Now with the advent of very, very good computing systems at low cost, it's a different world entirely. Graphics is really good today, too, and very cheap to do. The peripherals are still expensive, but things like Google Glass and things like that may eventually give us the technology at a level where it can be affordable to really deploy in schools everywhere.
I want to wander down a side path for a moment because something that you brought up there really caught my interest. There is almost a scale of philosophies within the world of education. You got teachers that love the kids that come in early and stay late and show up for office hours and really, really bust their humps and want to help those guys go as far as they possibly can. And then you got the other kids that are there and for whatever reason maybe aren't quite as focused, and there are teachers that like to help those guys get along and make the best of what they can. And it sounds like you were noticing some of these kids. And a lot of times those guys just get left behind, or those ladies just get left behind. And it sounds like there was a concern for you in saying, I'm not going to just see these guys drop out and say, okay, have fun at the gas station the rest of your life, but you wanted to do something about that.
Well, fundamentally, universities exist to educate students. That's why we were built. I mean, we do many things, but fundamentally that's why we exist. I can't forget that. At the same time, we're all differently gifted. I mean, every faculty member has different gifts. Every student different gifts as well. And so you try to find out how to really match those up. That's the problem. A good teacher can usually one-on-one find out exactly what that particular student needs to be successful. But when you take that teacher, put them from a classroom of hundreds, you have to homogenize it. You really can't do it that way. It can't be. And so the good students survive fine. They do well. But the students who are marginal may be the ones who are left behind because they don't get the specific thing they need delivered to them. And so the goal I had in this research was trying to find ways to reach that student and customize the experience just for them so they got the optimal learning environment. That was the goal. Yeah. Now, we were imperfect, obviously, in getting there, but I think we showed through some good research that it was effective. And again, the barrier at the time I did all this work was money.
Of course. And that's always a challenge. You spent some time, I understand, teaching at ODU at Old Dominion out in Virginia.
Yes.
And then we're called upon, as you said, into the world of administration at the Galveston campus of Texas A&M. And for people who are not familiar, Texas A&M is not just College Station. There are 12 or 14.
Well, let's be precise. There's actually 11 system members,
right, okay,
of which one is the flagship in College Station. That flagship has two branches. One historically in Galveston, Texas, over 50 years ago put there, and a second one over 10 years old in Doha, Qatar in the Middle East. Right. So those are all independent campuses, much like UMSL and UMKC and Rolla are sure. independent of this campus here in Columbia. So those 11 members are like that. But it so happened that the main campus, the flagship campus, had these two branches. So my boss when I was hired at A&M to be an administrator was a guy named Robert Gates, who became later the Secretary of Defense. And so he was my boss in College Station. I was in Galveston probably 2 days a week on the average in College Station, back and forth a lot. But that was a good time. I learned my craft there because I had a campus of about 2,000 students, about 400 faculty and staff where I could know everybody. And my mistakes weren't so evident. And the press count wasn't so high.
Right. So. Right. There's some advantages to the smaller schools.
So I made mistakes then and learned a lot from those mistakes. Went through a lot of problems. So we lost a faculty member in a sailing accident, a very, very, very difficult crisis for us. Hurricane Ike struck there in 2008. Mm-hmm. I had to move 2,000 people to College Station, which was a unique experience I don't want to repeat. But that taught me a lot, too, and we were successful. We got things done. We actually moved our students to College Station largely, and they were able to complete their studies there during a time the campus had to be closed because of the infrastructure in Galveston being just non-existent.
Going back to Texas was going home for him. You had moved around quite a bit, and now you're going to the Gulf Coast. What was that move like for you?
Well, I think Bowen and I discussed it very briefly, actually. he asked me, do you want to go back to Texas? And I said, you betcha. And so it was not that difficult a decision because my mother was still at the time living in Texas at Bowen's, actually, his family farm. And so, yeah, I was actually glad to get back to Texas to be closer to her.
And Galveston's just a beautiful place, isn't
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely.
Wonderful,
yeah,
wonderful
really
place.
Enjoyed that.
You talked a little bit about this, Dr. Leffler, but you came in at kind of a difficult time. You had a lot of educational experience, a lot of time on different campuses, and you obviously knew A&M very well. What other skills do you feel like you brought in that helped make you successful at Galveston, at CS, and now obviously here at Mizzou?
Well, I think the fundamental skill that I have, if you will, is people. I've said this in my inaugural speech a while back in September. My dad was a person who was not educated well. He finished sixth grade, and he was 13 years old. His father said it was time to go to work. That was the way it was.
Of course. Went
to a one-room school, so he could read and write, do arithmetic. That's all he really had educationally to back him up. And he knew that was a very big barrier to his progression, if you will. I learned as I grew up with him, he was a very bright guy. He was very intelligent, but simply not able to progress a lot because of his lack of education. But he had an innate skill with people. My dad could make friends with anybody. And so he'd walk into a strange room, and within moments he could meet you for the first time and find some commonality, mm-hmm. something you could talk about. And I just assumed as an only child watching him as my role model growing up, that was a common skill. Well, it's not.
No, it isn't.
And so I don't know that I really if it's DNA related at all, but I simply saw that as an example that I tried to follow. And I've always tried to be somebody who can relate to people. I like to be a person who I can connect with others from my perspective. I don't want to be a person that's unapproachable. I want to be somebody you can come up to and meet and talk to, and we'll find some way to link ourselves together. That's my goal typically. And I use that every day with our students here. I meet students every day. I like to talk to them. I like to find out where they're from, but also why they came here. What brought them to Mizzou? Why are you right here right now? What's your experience like right here right now? And it's a very insightful thing. Social media gives you today a way I never had before to be able to reach many more. So when I'm not in town, which is all too frequently, when I'm not on the campus, I'm able to still connect to my students, and they can connect to me. So I use that for access purposes primarily.
We're going to ask you guys this question a little bit later, but in talking with the students, you've been at a lot of different schools, and I'm sure there are some common themes. I came to the campus, and it was really beautiful. My granddaddy went here. I grew up being an Aggie fan, a Tiger fan, whatever it might be. When you talk with the students at Mizzou, what have you found that's maybe different about what's bringing kids into this campus as compared to other schools you've been at?
Well, not so much really, in terms of differences when you compare this campus, say, to Texas A&M.
Right.
Here you have two flagships, both the largest schools in their states right now, schools who are really built around access to a variety of people in terms of their socioeconomic backgrounds, other measures of diversity. So these schools fundamentally, I think, attract the same kind of student. Most of our students here are middle-class kids and below who really come here because we're not that expensive. I mean, tuition is not cheap, but it's not as expensive as many places among the publics. It's a culture here of acceptance that I think is pretty high. We have things to work on, obviously, but I believe we're pretty good about that. And it really feels good. So you talk to a kid here who has no connection. Maybe they're, you know, many do have a grandparent, parent, whatever, maybe five generations sometimes. But if they have no connection and you ask, why Mizzou, they'll tell you two things. They'll tell you, well, I did a campus visit.
Yeah.
And the visit made me really impressed by the beauty of the campus. That was my first impression. But then they talk about this tour guide, this sophomore junior that took them around the campus, walking backwards for hours without falling down. And this student not only answered questions and talked about the campus, but they shared something else. They shared their love. They shared passion for the University of Missouri. And that's something you can't fake.
Right.
So this tour guide, you know, communicated very effectively to 17-year-old walking around the campus those few hours. Wow, this is a great place to be.
Mm-hmm.
Without even saying it quite that way. That intangible communication between these people just 2 years apart, probably in age, 3 years apart in age here, is the most incredibly powerful mechanism to bring a student here with no other reason to come here.
Interesting. Now, on a different but somewhat related note, we talked about you having gotten to Galveston, and it wasn't much longer that you took the presidency at A&M. You grew up pretty close. You went to school there. You were an Aggie for a very long time. Is it fair to say that once you got into the world of doing this type of work, the presidency of Texas A&M must have been pretty close to a dream job for you?
Well, I guess it could have been. I wasn't thinking of it that way. I came to Galveston for odd reasons in a way. I mean, I had a connection. I had taught there 1 year back in the 70s.
Okay.
And so one day a guy named Bill Seitz, whom I remembered, actually helped me get the job there. He was a Rice graduate, and I met him when I was in grad school at Rice. And he was looking for a job then. I happened to get a connection to Galveston, and I left as he came, basically. But he was still there all these years later, and we simply had a conversation about the opening for the CEO position there, and he suggested I be a candidate for it. And I hadn't thought about that, really. But he was the one that kind of pushed me on this particular process or roadway. And it was not something I thought would happen, because the history had been they'd always had an administrator from College Station come and do that job. And I thought it'd be a kind of a closed search, basically.
Yeah.
And the end result was two finalists, me and an administrator from College Station.
Okay.
And Gates picked me for some reason.
They're getting, in a lot of different ways in higher education, trying to bring in maybe, and Galveston isn't the same as bringing somebody in from Cornell or Oregon State or whatever, but trying to get some different ideas as opposed to just promoting from within, sometimes more now than they used to, it looks like.
I think Missouri is sort of an example. There have been quite a few leaders here, not all, but quite a few who've been internal in terms of their of their origins here. They came through the ranks, basically. Brady's the most recent example of that. Brady was here many years.
Right. Dr. Wallace.
Dr. Wallace as well. And so that was, I think, a more common pattern than most at universities, both public and private. I do think there is value, though, in fresh eyes. Not that I'm any better than anybody else, but when you have a different set of experiences – and you come into a new place here, you see it differently.
Sure.
I call it the wallpaper effect. If you put up wallpaper on the walls, after a few days, you don't see it anymore. You're living in it. And when you walk in fresh, though, you see the wallpaper pattern. You see things that the person living in the house doesn't really see anymore. And so I have the opportunity to come in here and see things perhaps others hadn't seen for a while because I was just new and I had a different background than they had.
And that's part one of our visit with R. Bowen and Karen Lofton of the University of Missouri. It's Thinking Out Loud from KBIA. Be sure to listen in next week for part two of our conversation with the Loftons. We'll hear about perhaps the biggest decision Dr. Lofton had to make while at Texas A&M and one we shared here at Missouri, leaving the Big 12 Conference for the SEC.
Well, it was a big deal. Leaving something where you'd been a long time was difficult, although realized the Big 12 was not that old.
Sure.
And the first part of the book that we put together, Rusty and I put together a few months ago, dealt with the background. What was it like in the 90s here as the old Southwest Conference began to break apart? And that was a key piece to understand. Clearly at that time, the people at A&M thought the SEC was a good place to go. They made an effort at it then, but the politicians in Texas, especially the two most powerful leaders there, said no, because one was a Baylor graduate, one was a Texas Tech graduate. So they kind of forced the Big Eight to become not a 10-team conference, but a 12-team conference by really forcing Texas Tech and Baylor into that mix.
Yeah.
And that set the stage for what happened more than a decade later. It was simply a matter of a conference coming together for the wrong reasons and being built around a TV contract more than around commonality.
And while we talk about serious issues like higher education, we also ask the question that everyone's dying to know. What is the deal with the bow ties? Where did that come from?
It's my personal brand, sir.
Okay, man.
A long time ago, this is very early in my academic career, I was a physics professor, untenured at the time, very junior, at another university. And one day, I mean, I dressed typically in slacks and open collar shirt. It was the culture of the department. No ties were worn typically, except maybe by the department chair, that sort of thing. And so I walked into the mailroom one day, and there was my box, everybody else's box, too, a letter from the university president that said, henceforth, all men will wear ties when they teach class. Well, faculty hate being told what to do.
That's next week, Thinking Out Loud on KBIA. We want to thank for tonight's show, first, the Loftons themselves for their extraordinary generosity of time. We thank, as is so often the case, the university's news bureau and Christian Basie, who was instrumental in putting this show together. And we thank the staff of the Office of the Chancellor here at the University of Missouri for their assistance as well. The director of KBIA is Dr. Mike Dunn. Our program director is Kyle Felling. Tonight's show was produced by Sam Richmond. The associate producer of Thinking Out Loud is Trevor Harris. Remember to keep up with Thinking Out Loud on Facebook and Twitter. And remember to tune in next week, part two of our special Thinking Out Loud on KBIA. Until then, for the doctors, Bowen and Karen Lofton, I'm Darren Helwedge. Have a good evening.